Hello, friends. It's been a long time. Thank you for your continued support and love. I appreciate it all so much. I've started a brand new radio station, Daily Wood Radio, and you can listen now on dailywoodradio.com or download our apps. You can go to your app store on Google Play or iPhone and download Daily Wood Radio. We're also on Apple TV and Android TV. You can even ask and enable a skill on Alexa to play our radio station, which is so amazing. So join the happy wave with Daily Wood Radio. I still do my live show every weekday, 8 a.m. Pacific time, 10 a.m. Central. Tune in. It's a lot of fun. This interview is Jay Rodriguez, who joined me for a special Morning Wood episode, and we have such a great chat. Like, literally, this guy is the sweetest thing ever. So thank you, Jay, for being on the show. I wanted to give everybody, like, you know, here's what the show is all about. We play music, we have guests, we talk about current events, we talk about what's going on. Daily Wood Radio is a station for everyone, but we are an exclusive LGBTQ+, our straight allies radio station. So we play music for everyone, from the 70s to today, and all the jams in between that you want to hear. It's so much fun. Make Daily Wood Radio a part of your day today. I love you. Be safe. Be well. Let's get this show started. The Kirk Collins Show, ain't it? But download our apps today and make Daily Wood Radio a part of your day. I love you, babies. Hi, everyone, and welcome our special guest today. From Broadway, TV star, movie star, pioneering original on reality TV, singer, actor, host. Welcome, Jay Rodriguez. Hi, Jay.
It's so good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for coming on. I am just so excited to have you here today.
Well, honestly, these are the kind of moments that I've been really, out of all the devastation and the horrible things that have happened all year, out of it, we've really kind of virtually connected more than I think I ever have my entire career. So it's nice in that sense.
I mean, you've been really connecting with your fans, especially using Facebook Live and doing all these really cool events.
Yeah, April 11th will be 1 year from going live every single day. When the pandemic first hit, many of us gig workers were like, well, how are we going to work? Our entire income is usually around having live audiences, and everyone had to pivot. And the first thing that came up was a digital drag fest that PEG management was doing, and they rep a lot of the drag queens from Drag Race. And they reached out and said, we're including cisgender men, pretty much just anyone within the community. Would you like to do a show with us? And I was thrilled, and I didn't really, you know, think much other than selling tickets and everything. And then I realized, oh my God, for some folks out there right now, $10 is an investment that they may not have. So let me just do the entire show for free the next day on Facebook. And that sort of began this journey of my little happy hour tribe on Facebook and Instagram that I call Jaybirds, because that's my onset nickname. Jaybird, get to set. So it's been a journey, but out of that, I developed a website. I have merch that literally is almost sold out that just got released on Sunday. So it's been a really affirming time to be able to take the professional side of my career in my own hands. So I'm not waiting around for a phone call.
Right, like for auditions,
yeah,
for new gigs.
Yeah, I actually thought it was going to be the opposite. I thought that networks would be making double the programming as if some way to catch up. But instead this year, networks, for whatever reason, are making half the number of pilots that they normally make. So that means less work for actors. So this bit of virtual entertainment and all the kind of sideline work that people have now developed this year is going to likely, you know, continue carry on until things get it to a more manageable space. And I think for me, I've, you know, told my Jaybirds that I'm not going to be stopping anytime soon. I think it's a blessing. Even if you tour the country and you are one of the Drag Race girls, you're not going to hit everywhere. But if you have a virtual experience that people can, you know, buy into or view for free, then all of a sudden you're staying connected with everyone that wants to support you and feel connected and supported themselves.
And I've seen some of your lives and people love it. And they'll be like, you know, they're like sad if they missed it. They're like, oh, I missed yesterday. I'm sorry. You
it's know, so
I was like, wow.
I know. And, you know, I've tried to really mix it up. Like yesterday I did Makeup Mondays and I put a four box photo thing up and I do A, B, C, D. And it's usually like drag queen eyes. And I was like, okay, pick one. And yesterday Facebook picked Valentina and Instagram picked, okay, of course, Trixie Mattel.
Yeah,
I have to tell you, that was the most difficult thing I learned after. I was like, okay, that's what I should have done differently. I didn't have all the tools I needed, but Valentina pretty much came out great. But they look forward to things like that. And, you know, in each instance, I only give myself an hour. And today's Trivia Tuesday. It'll be trivia. And so that'll be on Facebook. And then on Instagram, Tom Felicia, the OG design guy for the interiors, he's hopping on. I'll test his knowledge and see if I'm smarter than a Queer Eye guy.
That is so fun. And I mean, wow, I love it. So well done. It's you're making the most out of it.
I am.
And really giving people something to look forward to.
Well, also a lot of this stuff is things that I think one of the biggest things was learning who follows my social media and why. And, you know, static posts are great. Photos are great. Videos and shares, it's all great. But going live has given me a real window into the community that has been long time supporting me as an individual. And, you know, I think starting my website, Jay's World, was kind of my version of the sort of Patreon style buy-in. And I've made the commitment to kind of pull back the curtain and the mystique of Hollywood and the thing that seemingly divides fans from the person that they're following and supporting. And what's come out of that has been a real opportunity of growth in people to really treat everyone the same. We've been able to tackle really difficult topics as the year brought them to us in real time by someone that was not coming from a shame-based place, but sharing my experiences from, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement to politics to on lighter days, you know, makeup trivia. And like you said earlier, I'll do cabaret shows. And to be honest, on a human note, I was one of those people that was petrified about how am I going to make rent, especially when unemployment checks were so delayed. I had left a job in radio, as I know I told you offline, in December because I was working so much in television, and I did a year and a half in radio, and it was an experience. And moving away from that, I really did assume the TV work would continue. And that certainly January 2020 proved that right. I booked The Rookie in a very dramatic role. I was the commercial, which was the first time for me. And then even in Queer Eye, I don't think I was ever featured in 100 episodes in the commercial. And then we did the Family Feud, Queer Eye versus Queer Eye. G's one, Kyan and I literally said going in, no matter what, you and I are doing Fast Money, because we know if we get lined up by executives in order, they'll put Carson, Tom, right, Ted, me, because they don't want to put the person of color last, but I always get to be second to last. So it's a whole different thing to kind of be able to come into this 17 years later, it was when we shot this. And for Kyan and I, who are kind of usually dismissed, to say, we're not going to be this time around. And it's, we're not discussing it. It's not debatable. We're just going. So we just went backstage when we want. We didn't even do it. We're like, we're doing it. Bye.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
We're raising money for the Trevor Project, right?
Yeah, everyone was tossing around ideas. And I just felt like in terms of LGBTQ issues, one of the biggest things that people stop me for, no matter how old they are, is the visibility piece. And if I, as the youngest cast member on my cast by a decade, inspired young folks who didn't feel seen, heard, or felt safe where they were, then I felt like it was our job to continue doing that work and supporting LGBTQIA youth who are disproportionately impacted by the pandemic, might be living in homes that don't fully accept them, being in spaces that are dangerous to them, and feeling alone. And the Trevor Project does incredible work, including their helpline and so much more, to really reach out to these kids and let them know that they are seen, heard, protected, and loved.
Yeah, I love the Trevor Project. So that was amazing. So well done.
Thanks.
That's great. I wanted to ask you, so, you know, your big break, I think, came in Rent, right? As Angel?
Yeah.
On Broadway?
Yep. Uh-huh.
I wanted to know, what was your favorite part of performing on Broadway?
Well, let me tell you the backstory. So this is so crazy. So I went to Performing Arts High School on Long Island for junior and senior year. We moved to a more affluent neighborhood where the actual high school itself did not offer those services. Certainly, they had a drama department, like an after-school program. But I found out there was a charter school, and it was actually an extension of vocational schooling, meaning you could, in the same program, the same system that took students from all over different counties and put them in facilities to learn a trade, they also had a facility that was a performing arts high school. And I think it was established in the early 90s, if not the late 80s. And so it's pretty much brand new because maybe it was the early 90s. I mean, I graduated in 1997. And so that kind of tracks, maybe it was the early 90s, but it was pretty much brand new. And all our professors and teachers were working professionals themselves. These weren't people who are aspiring to kind of get somewhere. They'd gotten there. They'd done it. They were able to, I mean, let me tell you something. When I got to my first performance in musical theater class, honey, I thought I was it. Cause I was it in my home school, you know, at the school plays, I did all the leads. I was like, you know, I was it. And when I got there and did my first thing and the teacher looked at me blankly and was like, okay, a couple notes. I was gagged, but that's what I needed. And it gave me the confidence that when the senior, final show or the showcase to showcase all the seniors happened, I had no college plans. My mom and I had a very strained relationship. My grandparents basically raised me until I was 12. And then, you know, living with my mother, who was a strict evangelical, we spent a lot of time at church and not much time building a relationship we never had. So, in many ways, my love of theater and all that stuff was not allowed in the house. We had no TV, no secular music, only things for the glory of God. So my friends got really, really clever. And what they would do is burn a CD and write like Amy Grant on it or whatever. And it was contraband. And I would have like, you know, Billy Porter's version of the remake of Grease where he sings Teen Angel. And I would try to riff and run to that with my headphones on. And then, you know, things like Rent and so many others. And that inspired me to really believe that I could be a performer. But to be truthful, I didn't have access to be able to go to college. My mom felt strongly that that was going to be not a good career path. She didn't have the finances, means, or desire for me to really leave the island and explore other things because you just didn't do that in my family. She had never seen it reflected. And I think in many instances, maybe that's a protective parental thing where you don't want them to fail. But on a broader level, it definitely had to do with religion, faith, and God. And so when I had this class, this person who was an alumni came back, saw the senior showcase. She was on a sitcom. And she said, I think you need to meet my agency. She set up an appointment for me. This was the summer I graduated. So this is literally like July 1997. And I went in and met with this agent. I don't know nothing. I mean, I'm wearing an oversized suit that, you know, like ill-fitting suit. And I'm 18 looking 14, you know what I'm saying? And so you can get a visual of that. And she had me read some audition sides, like, you know, to see if I could act. And then she said, can you sing? And I was like, yeah, I can sing. Close the door. I sang Glory from Rent. And she was like, oh my God, they're auditioning Rent today. If I sent you right now, could you go? And I was like, yep. And I went, wow. I went to the Duane Reade. I wrapped that blazer around my waist, like a little skirt, tied around my waist, got some clear lip gloss and went to that audition for Angel and got a call back on the spot. The next audition I had was for Bernard Telsey himself, who is the big, massive casting director now in television and film, but really has based in Broadway. And he looked at me after my audition and said, why have I never seen you before? And that stopped me in my tracks because I was like, I don't have a headshot or a resume. He's like, I would have cast you without any of those things. It just really was affirming that I was at the right place, right time, and that this was the right moment. And so I became the youngest person ever cast in a leading role in Rent. They did send me to Canada to open the international company, the first ever in Toronto. So I lived there for 9 months, Ottawa for a month, Vancouver for I think almost 3 months, and then came to Broadway. I actually moved to New York with, you know, after the tour was over in Canada with no expectations that I would be in the Broadway cast. And I slept on a friend's couch because I hadn't really saved. Our notice kind of came, but they're like, you're closing in 2 weeks. And I was like, wait, no. So I slept on a friend's couch and she was Maureen at the time in the Broadway version, but she'd come from my cast. And she said, you know, I know that they're actually getting rid of one of the swings. Would you consider that? And I was like, oh God, I don't know if I want to understudy. I just played the lead. And she was like, but it's Broadway. I was like, yeah, it's Broadway. Just, yeah, put it in their ear, whatever. So sure enough, the next morning they called me and they're like, hey, would you consider coming on to swing? We need someone because Wilson Cruz is leaving and we already have an angel picked out, but we would like you to come in and, you know, stand by and cover like 5 other roles. I was kind of really excited to be able to play other characters, to sing the Will I solo, to play the Seasons of Love soloist, all the cool things that people didn't think I could do. The show Rent itself, especially if you're a swing, it really taps into, and by the way, the swings at this time are like Tony Award winners now. I mean, we had Leslie Odom. He was 17 at the show. He was in the ensemble. He never went on for the leads, but I was 19. And then we had Karen Olivo, who won the Tony for West Side Story, who's now Satine on Broadway in Moulin Rouge when it comes back. And so it was a good gaggle of folks. And then, you know, just a few months later, our Angel had to step out of the show. And then I became Angel at 19, making me the youngest person ever cast a leading role in that show. But I'll tell you, that discipline of 8 shows a week and being on time and knowing your lines, and people on set on television shows now are, when I'm first on set and know my lines, they're like, "You're a theater guy, aren't you?" I was like, yeah.
They know. They're like, okay, we can absolutely tell. Because 8 shows a week is no joke.
And like, especially you don't singing. Yeah, holiday weeks like Thanksgiving and stuff, the days off are put on either end of those 8. So you could do 15 shows in a row.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is wild.
Yeah,
that is wild. Did your mom go and see Rent?
So it's interesting because she came to visit me in Canada. This is, you know, right out of the house. We still were kind of estranged. I mean, my coming out story, I did a one night only concert for the Actors Fund in a massive theater in New York, a Broadway show. And I basically wrote my coming out story as happened. So basically, I was going to go off to college, and I had to tell my mom, well, I got this Broadway show. And I remember the conversation wasn't about me being gay. We didn't have a I'm gay. We had a I'm taking this show, playing this character. And I let her listen to Seasons of Love. That's like a nice little gospel song, you know, and she's like, "We love that. They mention love is a gift from up above." And she's like, "Yes, praise Jesus." Then she was like, "Well, no, but I want to hear one of your solo songs." And so I put on Today for You, and she was like, "Stop kidding around. Sounds like a girl." And then there became my 1997 language, which, you know, we didn't have the language, especially those of us who were so sheltered, to explain. And I was like, "No, it was just like a boy in a dress, but like he's the heart and soul and the guy won the Tony." And she's like, "Wait, is he gay?" And I was like, "Yeah, but he's like," and she was like, "What? So you're going to do this? You're going to go leave and do this show and live a sinful lifestyle and turn your back on God?" And I just didn't have the language to really stand up and affirm a job when I myself had never been with a man up until that point. So I had nothing to draw. I was claiming something and defending something that I knew was a piece of my identity, but I had no experience. And so it was a really tricky conversation that did not end well. I think her final words were, "Well, you have to go, you have to leave. I don't want that sickness in my house." And so I left. And I remember, you know, I think, you know, I started the show October 20th, 1997. So I think 24 years ago, this fall. And then I went to, you know, about 4 months in, I think maybe in February, she, you know, was gone out of the house for a good while. She came to visit. I ended up being sick that weekend. So we didn't really do much. We kind of walked around the city a little bit. I wasn't in the show. But then when Queer Eye came around, I was doing Rent for 5 years. I had left to do an off-Broadway show, which is now a cult classic, called Xana Don't. And I played Xana. And, you know, the whole time, that half decade that I was doing theater, my mother's friends and folks at the church would say, "You know, we heard about your son, you know," and she's like, "Yeah, keep him in your prayers." But the minute that Queer Eye hit the airwaves and the world collectively on a massive scale was celebrating us and praising us, she was like, yeah. She went from pray for him to, "Well, yeah, I taught him everything he knows, you know."
Oh, how our tune changed.
Yeah, and so that was really tricky because we were still estranged. We didn't have a relationship. But the shame around that, you know, is deep for me. I think a lot of people are like, "Oh, your parents must be so proud." And it's a really layered and deep conversation that I don't want to drag my mother for. However, I also believe there's power in speaking your truth. And so I was striking a delicate balance during the Queer Eye days, and including I would just basically kind of give her a mini makeover, send a car service for her. She would play her role at events and I would play mine. But in actuality, we didn't have much of a relationship. It was fueled by mutual shame that people would find out that we didn't have a relationship, because there were so many questions around it. And, you know, she got married the year I'd moved out of the house when I was 18, had a baby when I was 20, and married someone very evangelical who didn't really even want me around the kid because he was scared the gay would rub off. So years pass, Queer Eye finishes. I moved to Los Angeles to continue working in television. And we kind of had scattered interactions throughout the years. And then I think just kind of saw it best to not be in each other's lives. They think there's a toxicity that can exist in these kind of dynamics where you're constantly being damned to hell. And also, I understand that for what she went through, and this is, I think, relatable going back to the Trevor Project, you know, she didn't have the understanding that or the access to information the way parents and folks have now, or even seeing positive representation of LGBTQIA folks in media. So she had nothing to draw on except her biblical scriptures. So, you know, even today we don't speak. It's hard to build. Some people get a little triggered by that, but we never had a traditional mother-son relationship. So in many ways, there's nothing to miss for me there. It wasn't, right. You know, if the plane is going down, I'm not wishing for my mommy. You know, I kind of parented her. And so that's why I feel so strongly about organizations like the Trevor Project and made them the beneficiary. But most importantly, to let other people know that, you know, you may not have the coming out experience with your folks that you dream of, but certainly there's a lot more room for acceptance now than I think there ever was before.
A lot of that's because of you. So thank you.
You know, it's wild, but I remember dating a psychologist and he was like, oh my God, you're in my textbook. I was like, what? He was like, it's talking about acceptance in media and queer folks and talking about how, because we were the first all out gay cast in network history ever. You know, and so it was a big deal, and it isn't until, you know, speaking with people like you and being reminded of that stuff, and as I've gotten older, the frequency that people share that it really hit. At the time, absolutely did not think we were doing anything other than cleaning toilets and zhuzhing.
Getting people looking better. You know, it was my grandma's favorite show, so you actually really did help me out a lot, because like you, I also grew up very religious Catholic. Altar boy at two churches. And so, you know, it was a different time. It was a very different time. And like, you know, thankfully you guys came along and I think help opened up everyone's minds. And I remember the first time I really saw you was on Malibu Country. And I was like, oh my God, who is this fabulous guy who's so funny?
That's the craziest part. Malibu Country was a sitcom on ABC that people can still watch using the ABC app. And what is so remarkable about that moment for me, that I had done pilots before that hadn't made it to television in scripted spaces. And the one I'm thinking of called HMS, Harvard Medical School, was actually written and created by the woman who created The Resident and wrote Mystic Pizza. But the star of that show is Megan Boone, who's the star of Blacklist now. And I played her best friend on it. We were Harvard medical students, and it was sort of an ensemble piece. Did not get picked up. We got put on hold for a year, but had that gone forward, that would have made me the first person from reality to become series regular. Instead, that went to Kathy McPhee. But Malibu Country made me the first male to get global fame off of reality to do scripted TV as a series regular, because there was a stigma attached to people who worked in the non-scripted space. You just kind of weren't allowed to be seen. And so I thank God people like Ryan Murphy, when I came to LA, saw me for projects like Nip Tuck, where I had this great role. They named the episode after my character. So it was a blessing that people over time kind of started disassociating me from Queer Eye. I grew out a beard. I got all the tattoos I wanted, things I couldn't do when I was under contract at Rent and Queer Eye, because a lot of people don't know that producers have to have approval when you change your aesthetic. So it was really just, I took Queer Eye off my resume and started from scratch as an actor, and really, you know, got to a place where I'm at now, where, you know, I'm one of the first seen for roles when they're right for me. And that doesn't just mean fabulous characters like Joffrey in Malibu Country, as seen on The Rookie, where I play kind of a guy on the edge, a bit of a murderer type. So, you know, it kind of varies, and I like that.
And I wanted to ask you about playing a transgender woman. You played a transgender woman on, was it Harry's Law?
Yeah, so Harry's Law was a book, actually. I think it was written for a man, and then Kathy Bates, they made it for television, and I think that Kathy Bates then took the role and made it a female lead, and I remember the breakdown specifically said no drag queens, no trans women. So think about how far we've come. Wow. The David E. Kelly production, Ally McBeal, Boston Legal, all these great shows that he's done. And I wanted to be a part of it. And I remember that sitting with me so weird. And at that time, I looked to my peers, people like Alec Mappa and Wilson Cruz, who had all played trans women in big ways. And I kind of felt like if I played her with the integrity, dignity, and respect that she deserved, that it was okay. Now, I would never, ever audition for a trans role, because I know the reason why you didn't see more trans representation is because networks were not willing to put trans actors in scripted roles. I mean, you have Candace Cain Kane, who a couple years after I played Amanda, did get Dirty Sexy Money. She was a guest star at first, and then she did become series regular before Laverne Cox did Orange is the New Black. A lot of people don't know that. But, you know, it was one of those things where that was what people were doing, and it became problematic and was problematic because you were literally alienating an entirely large group of diverse individuals who happen to be of the trans experience from, you were blocking them from being able to tell their stories. And I know this to be true because when I got on set, the hair department saw me as a drag queen. Makeup understood she was trans. The author of it, I think it was David, he even kind of dipped into language that was really confusing and tricky. And when trans women perform in the art form of drag, generally we call them showgirls. And, you know, they've long since been in the ether and all the kind of spaces that have drag entertainment. You're bound to find trans women performing in that art form because employment for trans folks is really difficult and tricky. And some women started as drag queens and then later transitioned. And so, you know, we're having these kind of conversations now, certainly with Got Mick on RuPaul's Drag Race this season and being a trans man. I think people attribute a lot of binary standards to male and female. He happens to be a trans man who's more effeminate, as many of us are, you know, more effeminate right. men. And so it just shows there's a full spectrum when it comes to gender and gender expression. And so I would never play a trans woman again, but I do, I loved that character and I love that I was able to be on set and educate other people on trans issues. However, it would have been better had they actually put aside their bias and hired an actual, I could count off dozens of friends I could call that would have killed that role.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's a hard thing because it's such a different time, I feel like, but you know, like we're really in the right direction, headed towards the right direction, especially with our new administration. They seem to be
Yeah, and I think
so on board.
Media too. I mean, you have entertainment and social media. You have public outcry. I'm not a part of cancel culture. I believe you should allow some grace for people who are willing to do what it takes to make amends and just do better. I'm so thankful that social media wasn't around during Queer Eye. I mean, I'm jealous of the new guys having, you know, a show that gives them millions of followers, and one post, I'm sure, from a product on their page is more than their weekly salary. But that's what I miss. But also, you know, I'm sure I stumbled along the way as a young person growing up super sheltered and had to learn how to do better when it came to advocating for my own community, just deeply rooted based in my own inner homophobia growing up that in some instances I had to shed. I mean, I'll be honest, if you look at the explosion of gay TV in the early 2000s, Will and Grace, L Word, Queer as Folk, you would be hard pressed to find any queer people of color. We just didn't get, and by the way, when we did get, we did all these photo shoots together with different casts. I was always in the fold, meaning you had to break that magazine wide
to find
see me, you know, and the issues around queer people of color were not being elevated. We had little shows like Noah's Ark and certainly other scripted shows that would pepper diversity in to meet a quotient, but they weren't telling fully our stories. We're never allowed to be 1, 2, 3 on the call sheet. So even though I was a part of the gay explosion, now you're seeing a more inclusive explosion of LGBTQIA programming because our experiences are not the same. We have some crossover, but like, you know, that's what we're on Queer Eye. They were like, oh, it's stereotypical. I'm like, I mean, for the five of us, it might be, this is who we are. We five people cannot give you a broad stroke of the global population that, you know, we're meant to quote unquote represent. We can just represent ourselves and hope that people find themselves reflected in that.
Right. And I think you did it. I mean, we've come a long way. So I'm really thrilled with it because I think of when I was a little kid in Sackville, Wisconsin. And I mean, the first time I think I saw a gay person, I think was Dawson's Creek.
Yeah.
They had a guy on there. And I remember watching it.
You're asking, but I'm curious. What was it like for you when you saw that? Because for me, I remember I had a visceral response of fear that someone would catch me watching this, or if there were other people in the room, if I was giving tells in my face about how I was receiving it. To this day, I have issues with public displays of affection as small as holding hands in public. That's my own stuff I grew up with. But when you first saw that, how did that hit you?
You know, I think I was just so confused about what I was. And I also had a lot of homophobia just because I was always taught, you know, gay is wrong. Yep. You know, the F word was thrown around very frequently. So part of me, I feel like, was thinking like, wow. And then the other part of me was like kind of disgusted. So I was like super torn.
Yeah.
But I still think it made a big impact, even in ways I probably didn't realize then.
Yeah, it was like baby steps, and I'm sure we could have gone a lot faster, a lot sooner, had we had, you know, I don't know if we had social media, whatever. I'm not sure what the uptick was. I do know that we were at the beginning of something. Certainly people like Ellen taking the bullet, losing their careers for a hot second. There's different standards. I mean, you know, I think why I brought up the gay explosions too, it was like, there was a certain aspect of, look, out of all the Queer Eye guys, all 10 of us that people know most commonly from the show, I'm the only one that during my time on air never got one endorsement deal, never got anything, you know. We made a small fee for doing the episodic show with no residuals. And, you know, every single one of my guys got a huge seven-figure or, you know, high six-figure deal, multiple deals. And it was very telling. And as I spoke to people in marketing and agents and managers, people in the early 2000s were very comfortable saying to your face, you're just not marketable. You need to butch up. You need to, you know, we don't know how to kind of sell you, you know, maybe tacos. Like, they couldn't figure out how the intersectionality of me being a Latinx person and being queer and slightly femme presenting at times was going to fit in or be accepted. You're fine to color my hair, but I don't know if I want to see you on screen. You're fine to decorate my apartment, but please don't kiss or get married. You know, it was a different time. And I think those small baby steps, those shows, Will and Grace, all the ones that people feel might be slightly problematic now, laid a foundation for us to see and then say, oh, okay, that's great. But, you know, and key rule of improv is yes. And so we've built and built and built on that. And this is going back, I guess, almost over 20 years, Queer as Folk hit the airways. So, you know, we're going on our 18th year anniversary. So finally, my
18 years. That is amazing.
I know.
Wow.
Wild.
You know, I was also going to say Ross Matthews, I think he had a big play in this too, because he used to be on the Jay Leno show. And I remember you were on the Jay Leno show too,
no,
right?
No, I mean, when he was on the show, we were guests. When he was being featured frequently, I think it was the year 2003, maybe two. And I remember thinking, listen to this, inner homophobia and projection. I thought, this kid will never go far because he's way too effeminate, and his voice and you know, he doesn't fit the type of the kind of gay that's excelling. And what did he do? He stayed true to who he is. And people don't like liars. People can smell a fake a mile away. And because he's so authentically him, he's unapologetically himself. That's why so many people like Lizzo, Cardi B, everyone who is garnering success for being just authentic outside of the norms, people usually flock to and celebrate, because we all wish we could be that way. And I'm so proud of that kid.
Yeah. I mean, my dad was like, I think it was the first time he saw someone like being, like you said, themselves. And he was like, funny. He was like, look at this gay guy on TV. He's funny. I was like looking at him like, what are you showing me?
Yeah. And it was interesting. A lot of the times I find from the gay community, the people that folks have problem with are the people who are celebrating life to the fullest in all the fabulosity. And I find that a lot of times in gay spaces, I'll use gay as an example, that sometimes people wish they could be that carefree, and they've built this mold for themselves. And so they like to tear down people like Carson Ross, JVN, Jonathan Van Ness, and they will feel comfortable confiding that in me. And boy, do I make the record scratch. Because I'm, you know, it all comes from a place of like a homophobic, like, you know, if someone's living their best life and you feel that that's not a representation of the kind of gay that straight people should feel comfortable with, why? Why?
Right.
I'm 41. I'll be 42 in June. There's no part of me that wants to live a life on eggshells anymore. I feel like I'm a kind, generous, open person who likes to leave this world a better place than the way I found it. And if I happen to wear glitter or I happen to be a little more fabulous in a moment, that does not impede on my ability to be a great human and an American.
Person.
And so I think a lot of that shaming, whether it's body shaming, people falling outside of the type that we're constantly advertised to, meaning if you don't have a six pack, you're not of worth. Respect all of that.
I think a lot of it comes from, you know, like as a kid, I'm also very feminine. So, you know, everyone was like, why are you so girly? Why you got to be a man? You know, like, I was like, you guys, I like the Spice Girls. I want to dance.
Yeah, and to be honest, I don't want all my friends to be the same. I don't want...
Right, and that's the beauty of LA, too.
And people evolve and grow, and I've been here a long time, and I've certainly had friends that were very, very close to me who've kind of, and especially in the past couple of years, evolved into more of an elitist, alienating type. And even Los Angeles, some of the conversations we were having this year around race and how it intersects with the queer community, you would think... I remember when I moved to LA, I was like, where are the people of color at? Like, where are they at? We're at the gay bar. Where are they at? And like, oh, well, like, there's hip-hop night there, there's salsa night there. I was like, what are you telling me? You're telling me that this, our bars are segregated? And they're like, well, not really officially, but like, they know where to go. And I was like, what is happening? Oh, and then that's reflected in the big major events. So if you see the private pool parties that'll have, you know, hundreds of guys in Speedos, and they always do a photo shoot with a drone and they publish them, you're hard pressed to find any person of color. You're hard pressed to find anyone who is embracing their body positivity and they happen to fall outside of the norm of a gym body. It's become an elitist space, and it probably always has been, but I think we're doing better in terms of trying to at least not just call it out to shame people, but to be more expansive about who we allow in the group, because you're really going to learn most from people who aren't like you and have different experiences, you know?
It's like stunning. You see these things on social media. You're like, how are these people friends with like their twins?
Yeah, like, the doppelganger thing.
It's just stunning. Oh, wait, Jay, I wanted to know just two more things.
Yeah.
One thing was you started in Rent with Mel B at one point.
I did.
Did she spice up your life? Was she pretty fun?
Mel B is amazing. Listen, I got to be honest. I really struggled reading her autobiography recently. I mean, if you haven't checked it out.
Brutally Honest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Brutally Honest.
Yeah.
It's really a great book. It talks about her life in the underbelly of all of it, but I wish I would have known more. I did see her after Rent, and I'm going to get to that. But when we were in Rent, she had a lot of self-doubt. I remember after Out Tonight and Another Day, No Day But Today. And then it goes into Will I. So everyone clears the stage except for the Will I soloist, who stays on the platform for a support group and sings the song on his own, the first verse. And then people trickle in until the entire cast is on stage. So her job, she runs off the stage. She gets on her kimono and she has to go up the stairs passing Collins and Angel, who are waiting at the foot of the stairs because there's another entrance to the stage there. So every single day can I curse on this? I don't want to.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
She would literally be like, fucking sucked in now. Fucking suck. Jay, tell me the truth. And I was like, no, you're no. Come
oh, Mel.
No, she just had a lot of self-doubt. And frankly, I after listening to what she went through and has gone through, you know, she is an incredibly talented, kind person. I remember, here's a fun story I don't share often. I don't know why this was a thing, but I guess it was a thing for me. For my final performance in Rent, when I went back, because I had left Rent abruptly to do an off-Broadway play for 6 months, then Queer Eye happened, so I didn't go back to Rent. But I wanted to, because when you leave a show you've been in a long time, there's a lot of pomp and circumstance. It gives the fans who come multiple times a month to see the show a chance to say goodbye. The company sings, you know, Happy Trails. You can give a little final speech. It's cute. And I didn't have that. And after half a decade of a commitment to that show, I missed it. So I went back for 3 weeks while doing Queer Eye. And that was when Mel B was in the show. And so my closing night then, I rented a party bus and I invited the entire cast to a strip club. No, not men. Women.
Women.
And, yeah. I gave everyone envelopes that had $50 worth of singles in them and got a little VIP table. And we went to a strip club. And I have to tell you really haven't lived until you've been in a strip club with Joey Fatone, Mel B, and me. It was a wild, fun experience, but it was like interesting now because I think this is before there was a lot of drag establishments. You know, there were drag performances, but I don't think they were any the day I was doing this. So I think that was the closest in my mind. I was like, we can go see strippers swing on bars.
Female strippers are so much fun.
They I love good so football. Much fun. I mean, it wasn't like we were going to the champagne room or anything, but it was like, I think they also knew us, like definitely knew me. They definitely knew Mel. They definitely knew Joey from NSYNC, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it became more of a performative show, you know, and it was fun.
That sounds amazing. Yeah. Next time I want to come. Thanks. So I just want to know what's next for you, Jay.
Yes. The Queer Eye Guys and I have reunited for a new series on E! Called Reunited that basically gathers old casts. But, you know, casts who've worked together before.
And, that worked together previously, okay.
Right, worked together previously. And I don't know what the other shows are going to look like, but I know that our episode is going to mirror a Queer Eye show. you're going to be very shocked at who the Queer Eye Boys will be making over this time around. That'll be interesting. And also it's celebrating my birthday, sort of combined thing. We shot this in the fall, so really at the height of the pandemic. So we had to isolate for 2 weeks. We had to have frequent testing. We had to have no exposure with anyone. Everyone on set who was in the crew had to wear a face mask and a face shield, N95, wow. KN95, the little paper ones. And then we couldn't even like be close to each other unless we were shooting. So we couldn't have conversations maskless when we were on breaks that weren't, 6 feet apart or more. So I felt really safe doing it. And thank God we had no casualties or anything that had happened, no infections from that production. But that's going to air soon. And then, of course, I do have my website, Jay's World. It's J-A-I World, W-O-R-L-D. It's Jay's World, all one word, .pubninja.com. But you can just find all that information on my social media. I'm just at Jay Rodriguez and all the things with a blue check mark. And like I said, I have this great happy hour that I do every single day, 4:30 p.m. Pacific on Facebook, and then 5:30 p.m. Pacific on Instagram. Everyone is welcome. You know, the Jaybirds have come up with this, the Jaybirds, and they love calling each other that and stuff. But what I love about it is, and I put it on my merch, because I wanted to remember this time. So there's a mug that says, Jaybirds, all feathers welcome, established 2020. Oh, and I just, that's kind of how we feel. You know, I mean, we have a lot of people who would never, ever have met in real life, from people who are non-binary to people of all different ethnicities, getting to really mutually unpack some of the social issues and how it relates to them. Now they are like calling each other and they're friends. And, you know, it's providing the safe space for folks to be who they are without judgment or fear, I think has been great. And by the way, I mean, this is a daily thing. So they've seen me, you know, cranky, they've seen me sick, they've seen me tired, they've seen me drunk, they've seen me happy, they've seen me cry. You know, I've had the whole roller coaster of emotions, because I thought, if I only go live when I feel good, then that's again adding to them thinking that I'm some, you know, massive celebrity that you don't make eye contact. I'm not that guy. I've never been that guy. I think that was the coolest thing about Queer Eye, after working with people like Beyonce, and, you know, I was a presenter at the VMAs when she won her first solo award, and you're around all these megastars, and then you go use the bathroom after them and you're like, ooh, yep, everyone's shit does stink. Okay. so it just is like an equalizer. And I think if I felt that, I just want people to, you know, not put people on pedestals and just treat everyone the same.
We're all people.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Congratulations. I mean, you've built this wonderful community. I've seen it. I love it. And I think it's so amazing what you're doing. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for coming on the show.
Yes.
And everyone go follow you, buy your merch.
Yes.
And I just can't wait to see what's next.
I'll send you all the links too, so you can have them as well.
Thank you. Yes. I'll post them all over.
Sounds good. Thanks, babe. I'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.